the 15th chapter of the Gospel of Luke, beginning at verse 11 and reading through verse 24. And Jesus said, "A certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the portion of goods that falleth to me.' And he divided unto them his living. And not many days after that, the younger son gathered all together and took his journey into a far country, and there wasted his substance with riotous living. And when he had spent all, there arose a mighty famine in that land, and he began to be in want. And he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he fain would have filled his belly with the husk that the swine did eat, and no man gave unto him. And when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and will say unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants.' And he arose and came to his father. But when he was yet a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion, and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said unto him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, and am no more worthy to be called thy son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring forth the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to be merry." A witty and unforgettable nursery rhyme is the one about the marketing pigs. This little pig went to market. This little pig stayed home. This little pig had roast beef. This little pig had none. Do you remember what a thrill it was as a child to have your mother count the pigs in that nursery rhyme on the toes of your feet? Well, of course you do. Tonight I want to talk to you about a Bible pig. He was not the barnyard type of pig. He was a two-legged pig. He was a pig with a man's body, or better still, a man with a pig soul. And interestingly enough, this pig also went to the marketplace and returned home for roast beef. His older brother pig, however, stayed home, and he had no roast beef. Of course, I refer to the younger son in the story which Jesus told that has come to be known as the story of the prodigal son. And there are several very crucial and graphic things which I note about this kind of pig in these verses which I read tonight. The first thing I note about him is that he was dissatisfied with the uneventful life he was leading. He didn't want to die where he had been born. The Bible nowhere tells us that he lived on a farm, but I gather that, as I read between the lines, that he was a farm boy. He had lived on that farm since the day of his birth, and his father had lived there before him, and his father's father before him. It was a part of the family. And the conventional thing would be for him to remain on the farm, to till the soil and to care for the livestock and to protect the family investment. But he cast aside all tradition, for this young fellow believed that it was time for a change, and nobody could effect that change as well as he could. I think he would have applauded Emerson had he lived in the day of Emerson, who said, "Whosoever would be a man must be a nonconformist." But he made a terrible mistake. He thought that the only way for a man to be free was by cutting himself off from his roots. Now, indeed, that does make one free. But it also means that one ceases to grow. And when one ceases to grow, he begins to die. He reasoned that nothing exciting ever happened around the home place. And since nothing exciting ever happened, he would go somewhere where exciting things were happening if he couldn't make them happen at home. He was hot-headed. He was impulsive. He was aggressive, and he was self-made. Now, certainly you cannot say that all initiative is bad. In fact, there wouldn't be anything going on in the world unless there was some initiative somewhere. People have got to be aggressive, or the world is going to stop. And I have never been particularly impressed with Barney Rubble on the Flintstones. Freddie is always saying to Barney Rubble, "Where's your get up and go?" And Barney is always saying, "My get up and go done got up and went." Now, when we find people like that without any initiative, we prescribe a diet of vitamins for them. Or we might even suggest that they have tired blood and they need a good dose of Geritol. We like go-getters. We like people who are ready to go and ready to do at the drop of a hat. And if you like that kind of people, and I do, you would have liked the prodigal son. For I don't think there was any inertia about the prodigal. I think this young boy was a man of activity, a man of industry, a man of great initiative, and I think he intended to do well when he got into the life of the city. And yet, self-assertion is the beginning of human rebellion. And rebellion is the root of all man's problem, all his sin. The limits which had been imposed upon him by his father, he totally and irrevocably rejected. He said to his father, "The house rules around here are getting on my nerves. And I believe that a man should be uninhibited. He should be allowed to roam and roar through the wilderness of the world like a lion roams and roars through the forest without a cage and without a padlock and without any inhibitions." And so he said to his father, "The time has come for me to leave this place. I want you to give me the portion of the inheritance which belongs to me." And so the father divided up his inheritance, a third to this prodigal, this younger boy, and two-thirds to the older son, as the custom was in Jewish families. Now, that wasn't unusual. When a Jewish father became too old to manage his business or his farm anymore, he would usually surrender the management and the operation of it to his sons, even while he was still alive. So in this case, he surrendered the management to his two sons. The older son stayed and cared for the farm, and the younger son wanted no part of it. So he took his share of the inheritance, and he went in pursuit of something better. Looking for excitement. Looking for a good time. The Bible says he took his journey into a far country, as far away from the father's house as he could get. What a commentary on modern life that is. For well, there are multitudes of people all around us in today's world who are seeking satisfaction and fulfillment and meaning in the far country. They do not believe they can find what life offers to them in the Father's house, and so they seek that satisfaction where ultimately it is not going to be found. It's one wild chase from one place of residence to another, from one job to another, from one spouse to another, one sensation and pleasure to another. And we keep diverting ourselves with TVs and deep freezes and vacations and sex and alcohol and narcotics and Cadillacs and mink coats. Anything that we can get our hands upon which seems to bring meaning to our otherwise meaningless lives. And yet in spite of all the sensation that we experience, we do not find the fulfillment that our hearts so desperately crave. And we hear the prophet saying to us, "Why do you spend your money for that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfieth not?" I really don't believe that the prodigal ever intended to get into trouble. I think he just wanted to find himself. And he didn't believe he could find himself as long as he remained under the inhibitions and the rules of his father at home. He just wanted to have a little bit of fun while he was finding himself in the world. Certainly no intention of getting involved in anything that would cripple or destroy him. No intention of getting caught in some kind of wickedness or profligacy or evil. He kept saying to his father, "I just want to be myself. I just want to do my thing." when in reality, what he was saying was, I just want to be rotten. And there are people today in our world who keep talking about being fully human. We want to be fully human, and we want the world to be fully human. And what some of these people mean by being fully human is being totally and completely animalistic, like the beast of the field, with no morals and no ethics. It seems to me that if a person is going to become fully human, he has to become fully Christ-like. For Christ was the perfect specimen of humanity. He was the man par excellence. He was the God-man who lived among us. And in fact, if we are going to be fully human, it means that we must revert to the stage of man in the Garden of Eden before his sin. For that is when man was fully human, and sin and wickedness and evil destroys the humanity of man and makes us oftentimes little more than animals. I walked in the parsonage last evening, and there were two houseflies sitting at the edge of a 5-acre piece of tanglefoot, and they were having a conversation, and I listened in. And the younger fly was saying to the older fly, what about this stuff? Is it sticky? And the older fly said, well, yes, it is. It's sticky. It's rather dangerous. It's risky. I wouldn't trifle with it if I were you. And the younger fly said, is it poison? No, he said, it really isn't poison. Is it bitter? No, it's not bitter. It's rather sweet, but I still wouldn't bother with it if I were you. And about that time, I saw the fly take off and make a 6-point landing on the tanglefoot. And the old fly turned in my direction, and he began to shake his head. And sadly, he said to me, it's a tragedy, isn't it? This young generation, they just won't listen to anything we have to say. They won't pay any attention to the older generation's experience. I've told him, and I've told him, and he had to learn for himself. He got what he wanted, but what he wanted got him. How true to life. People everywhere today are getting what they want and discovering that what they wanted entraps them. We get our possessions, and our possessions possess us. We never intend that that will happen, but it does happen, and we get caught in a kind of web, and we cannot extricate ourselves from this entanglement in which we find ourselves because we have pursued so desperately the things which we think we want and we think we need, when in reality they are not the things we want or the things we need, but they are the things which destroy us and all that God meant us to be. He was disillusioned with what he found when he got into the far country away from the Father's house. And that, too, is characteristic of our modern way of life. The Bible says he began to be in want. He'd eaten the best food. He had drunk the best imported wines. He had smoked the finest cigars. And he had danced with the loveliest women. But he was miserable. He had struck famine. He had struck the very bottom of his existence, and there was nothing left in the cup but the dregs of remorse. He had eaten from the flesh pots of Egypt, and it was good while it lasted, but now the flesh pots themselves had become empty. He had drunk from the cisterns of pleasure, but the cisterns of pleasure had run dry. And he finally resorted to eating the husk which the swine did eat. He was fed up, but he wasn't satisfied. Have you ever known people who were fed up with life? Full up to here, but they weren't satisfied. They weren't fulfilled. They remind me of a Christmas turkey, which is full and stuffed, but it's also dead. The world had deceived that prodigal. It always does. And that's why the Bible so graphically says, when he came to himself, he had been duped, unknowingly mastered. All the while, he didn't know what was happening to him. I read somewhere about a woman who went into the drugstore to get her bottle of medicine refilled, and there was a new druggist on duty that day. And he said, I'm sorry, ma'am, but I can't fill this bottle with this medicine because this is a habit-forming drug, and you will have to get a new prescription. And she became irate. And she flew into a rage, and she said, Sir, this is not habit-forming. I have been taking it for 25 years, and I ought to know. The prodigal didn't know what was happening to him. He was being controlled and mastered and destroyed, and he didn't know it all the while. We often say of a man who is moody or not acting in his usual way, he's not himself today. Did you know that that expression comes right out of the Bible? It comes right out of this story of the prodigal son. When he came to himself, we are not ourselves when we are away from God. We are madmen. We are monsters of greed and passion and evil when we are away from God. And we are only our true selves when we are doing His will, when we are on our way back to the Father's house. And so coming to himself, he made a new resolve. That's the resolve that Stuttered Kennedy called the decision twixt the muck and the golden crown. He said, I will arise and I'll go to my Father. And I'll say, Father, I've sinned against heaven and I've sinned against you and I'm not worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired servants. And in the last episode in this story, which Jesus so picturesquely paints for us, we see him returning home in pursuit of what he had left. Several years ago, I was called upon to preach in a church in the city of Louisville, Kentucky, the whereabouts of which I thought I knew. And so I started out one evening just in time to get there. And imagine my chagrin and embarrassment when I drove down the highway and I didn't find the church and I turned off on a side road and on another road into a dead-end street. And so I had to retrace my path back to the road off which I'd turned, and lo and behold, there was the church. I'd turned off the road I was looking for in search of it. We often do that. We do that in our relationship with God. We turn away from God, all the while looking for what God alone can give to us. We are like the proverbial drunk who was seen looking for his quarter under the arc light on the corner. Not because he had lost his quarter there, but because it was easier to see there. We look for what we want under the bright lights of the world, but we are not going to find it there. We're going to find what we've lost and what we so greatly need back at the Father's house. And so yonder he comes. I see him in my imagination, standing on the rise, overlooking the farmhouse where his father and his brother live, looking down into the valley, in nostalgia, remembering the kind of life he had enjoyed once there long ago. He wants to go back, but he is afraid. He is afraid that his father will not accept him. He is afraid that his brother will abuse him. He is ashamed of what he has done. He cannot face the past. And so he stands upon that rise, looking down at the farmhouse. And if you could see him, you would see the picture of dereliction and remorse. With his hair all disheveled, with his face dirty, with his clothes in tatters. Not an ounce of respect left. Nothing but shamefulness. Finally, he begins with his leaden feet to move down the side of the mountain, realizing now at last that what he wanted, he had all along if he had just had sense enough to hold on to it when it was his. We never know what we have until we lose it, do we? We never know how wonderful a wife is until she dies. We never know how great home is until we can't go home anymore. We never know how wonderful God is until we've lost God out of our lives. And then we begin to recognize the value and the importance of those things which we took so for granted. You heard the story about the farmer who called in a real estate agent and said, I want to sell my farm. I'm tired of it. And so the real estate agent ran an ad in the next day's paper about the farm. And when the farmer read the ad, it was such a glowing description of the farm. He called the real estate agent and he said, forget it. That's the kind of farm I always wanted. I just keep it. The grass is not greener anywhere than it is in your own backyard. Certainly not greener than it is in the Father's house. And so he came back looking for love and friendship because he hadn't made one real friend in the far country. Oh, he had made some harlot friends and he had some buddies. But when his money was gone, and his respect was gone, and his decency had been taken away, He didn't have any friends left. They were all gone then. How different is friendship which is born of love? For love is far-sighted. The father sees him as he starts down the side of that hill toward the farmhouse. Who is it in that story that makes all the haste? Is it the prodigal? No, I think he came home very slowly and laboriously because he was afraid, he was ashamed. The one who makes all the haste is the father. For when the father sees his son coming in the distance, he runs out the door and down the dusty lane, and he embraces his dirty son in his arms, and with the tears running down his cheeks, he places a kiss on the cheek of his son, and he says, "Son, welcome home. I'm so glad to have you back." That's the difference in friendship, which is born of real love, and the friendship which is born out of an attempt to take advantage of us for what we can give. He returned in search of the lost security. The pig who had gone after the slop pails of the world had returned for the fatted calf, the roast beef of the Father's love. "Make me a hired servant," he said. "That's all I'm worthy of. There's some security in that." But you see, God's people have never been born to be slaves. We were born to be sons. And when we say, I have sinned, make me your servant, make me your slave," such a confession to God always makes us the sons of God again. Abraham Lincoln, whom we claim down in Kentucky, was an inimitable person. He was a great soul and a great spirit. And as the war came to a close, he was asked by some of his advisors what he would do with the southern states when the war was over, the states which had seceded from the Union. And Lincoln said, "Well, I'm going to treat the southern states as if they'd never been away." That's the way God treats us. Just like the father treated the prodigal son, as if he had never been away. He came home in search of forgiveness. Oh, how we all need forgiveness. But what does this story mean? Does it mean that God is a sentimental God? That God will pat us on the back and say, "It's all right, my boy. It's all right, my girl. I know you didn't mean anything by it. Just forget it. We won't mention it anymore." Is that the kind of God we have? If so, where is His holiness and where is His judgment and where is the punishment for sin? Archibald Hunter, a great scholar of England, tells a story about a modern prodigal who became sick and tired of the kind of life he had found in the city. And he walked into a minister's study one day and told his story. And he said, "I'm homesick and I want to go home. But I'm afraid to go home because my father is an austere man and I'm afraid of what he'll do." And the minister said, "Now, son, I think you must go home. I think you've misread your father. And I think if you go home, your father will welcome you home. He'll be glad to see you. And he'll kill the fatted calf for you." And so the boy went home. And several days later, the minister saw the boy on the streets. And he said to him, "Well, son, wasn't it just like I told you? Didn't your father welcome you home? Didn't he kill the fatted calf?" And the boy said, "Well, no, sir, it wasn't just like you told me. My father didn't kill the fatted calf, but he almost killed the prodigal son." Now, that's the way we treat prodigals. But God says, "My ways are not your ways. My thoughts are not your thoughts." God doesn't chasten us when we come home. God doesn't punish us when we come home. God doesn't ask any questions when we come home. God just throws His arms open wide and welcomes us back when we come home. Every parable of Jesus had only one central point. And I think we lose something of the significance of the parable when we try to find too many allegorical meanings in the story. And this parable says just one thing. It just says that God welcomes sinners, that a sinner can come home. And the Pharisees wouldn't believe that. They thought a man had to straighten up and reform himself before he could come home. And the publicans couldn't believe that because the news was too good to be true. But I'm fairly convinced that God is not nearly so interested in what you've done as He is interested in what you're going to do. He's not as interested in what you've been as he is interested in what you can become. And any man can obtain forgiveness and reconciliation with God the Father, just like the prodigal did, when that man does what the prodigal did. The prodigal recognized his sin. He said, I'm in a mess. And he stopped blaming his brother or anybody else. He said, it's my fault. I've done this to myself. And then he made a decision. He said, I'm going home to my father, and I'm going to confess my sin, and I'm going to ask his forgiveness. And that's the moment when Browning says, God stoops o'er his head, and Satan looks up beneath his feet, and both tug. What a hard moment that is, but what a crucial and decisive moment. Martin Luther used to say, every man's heart is a battleground between two masters. And every man will become either the slave of one master or the son of the other. We can become the children of God. We don't have to remain the slaves of Satan and sin and death. He left of his own self-will and returned of his own self-abandonment. When he left, he said to his father, give me what's mine. That sounds like us, doesn't it? And when he returned home, he said, make me what you want me to be. Make me a servant. I'm willing to take the lowest place. I'd rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than to dwell in the tents of wickedness. And the father called in his neighbors and he said, come over, we're going to have a party. Come over and rejoice with me, for my son who was lost is found. He who was dead is alive again. Well, there's some of us who are far away from God. Maybe some of us here. Certainly many in the world tonight, far away from God, lonely and homesick, not knowing what to do about it, wanting to come home and being afraid. Rufus Jones, the Quaker philosopher, tells about a traveling salesman who was traveling down the highway looking for a little village. And he drove and he drove and he drove and he couldn't find the village. And finally he stopped and asked a farmer beside the road where it was. And the farmer, knowing that he had just passed through the tiny village without even recognizing it, said to him, sir, if you keep going in the direction you're going, it's about 25,000 miles from here. But if you just turn around and go back, you can be there in 5 minutes. A lot of us, if we keep going the way we've been going, we'll never get back to the Father's house. It's when we turn around and come back to the Father, retrace our steps to His house, and make our confession of sin that the Father will welcome us home.